I am working the hardest I've ever worked in my career.
Your first video was super successful. It's still your most viewed video.
Before I knew it, it was north of 100,000 views. Now it sits north of 500. 5 days later, I was able to monetize on YouTube. I was like, this is easy. I got 5 inbound brand deals and I lost all of them.
Every journalist has this difficulty understanding the business side.
We're always thinking about the audience, but when you're thinking about your audience, you have to think about the product you're giving your audience. Why aren't we thinking about retention, about return customers, about churn, etc.?
What's the one thing that you would say, know this?
I have one.
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and today we're speaking with Fernando Hurtado, creator of In the Hyphen, a YouTube channel publishing deeply researched and visually rich stories on U.S. Latino culture. He comes from a media background. He quit his job at NBC and Telemundo 1 year ago to go all in as a creator. So we caught up to talk about that first year. Enjoy. We're speaking a couple of weeks before the 1 year anniversary of your first YouTube upload. We're planning to release this on exactly that 1 year anniversary. I want to start with the ups and downs of this first year as an independent creator. You left traditional journalism a little over a year ago. We'll get into that later, but I want to start with the disappointments. What did you hope to accomplish this year that you couldn't, or what was so much harder than you thought it would be?
I think sponsorships, I have gotten sponsorships now, but for whatever reason, I never calculated all the work that goes into getting a sponsorship published. Once even you negotiate the deal, the back and forth with getting approval on the ad read and the spot that will go in the longer video. It, not that it's been disappointing, but it was a, oh, duh, wake up call. Like, oh, of course, like I have to budget in time to, you know, send it like a week before the video publishes. Whereas before sponsorships, I was really like, you know, up to the minute publishing, finishing a video. Yeah. Only counting on me, and like, I'll get it done by the time it needs to get done. So that's been probably the biggest learning curve. And then the other one I think is not disappointing, but I am working the hardest I've ever worked in my career. But I am also in the most rewarding stage that I've ever been in my entire career.
But it sounds like the trade-off there is you are either flirting with or experiencing burnout.
I've never said no to so many birthdays, so many dinners, just to like save my mental peace as I have this year. Yeah, to avoid that burnout. Tough. I think I've gotten really, really close. But right now I'm in a good spot. Now I'm at the spot where I can travel and go visit my family and take time off and be fine. Like I'll figure out my publishing and not miss a single upload.
Realistically, that's not bad for a year in, which actually, this reminds me, I think this was on another podcast that you were on, and you were talking about how when you launched, you started with about a month and a half buffer. You had 5 videos ready, and you were seeking advice before you launched, and you talked to Cleo Abram, the famous big creator who used to be with Vox, and she said, 5 videos is way too many. You should just do 2 so you can be more reactive to your audience, which I thought that was great advice. But the buffer, if you started with a 5 video buffer and it disappeared, obviously life, you know, happens. That's what the buffer is for. Have you regained any of it, or do you even want to?
Now that I have a good volume of sponsorships, I have regained it, just because I kind of have to be aware of what's coming in a month and a half and know the video topic at the very least. So I start gathering some interviews for that. But what I didn't expect to happen is I'm actually happy I lost the buffer, because it allows me to respond much more to what's happening in the zeitgeist. You know, I did a video on the ICE raids that I was able to do and respond to kind of what was going on at that moment, which was this very Home Depot angle and kind of explaining why so many of them were and still are happening at Home Depots. So had I had that buffer, I think my contribution to that conversation would have been outdated and honestly not as much of a value add.
Yeah, I do want to talk a bit about the production process in a second. But while we're still on sponsorships, I know that your first video was super successful. It's still your most viewed video. When I checked last night before recording, it had 3.7 times as many views as your next most viewed video. And I understand that you got a good amount of inbound sponsorship talk just based on that How many of those closed? How much actual revenue came in for you based off the quick success of that first video?
Yeah. So my first video was about why so many Americans speak Chicano English, which is this variety of American standard English. It's very popular in LA. If you've ever been in LA, probably you've heard it in Texas. Some people call it the Latino, LA Latino accent. So the example I give is instead of saying something, you'll hear something, you know, with it, which has a bit of a Spanish I intonation. So I published that video, and the first like 2 days, it was in the hundreds, and I expected that. I had just launched the channel, and then it just took off. And before I knew it, it was north of 100,000 views. Now it sits north of 500 last time I checked. And
north of 600, by the way.
600. Oh, thank you. After I published that video, 5 days later, I was able to monetize on YouTube because of all the watch hours I got. So I was like, man, I've made it. You know, I was like, I'm rich. You know, I've done it. And then I started getting all these like inbound brand offers. I was like, this is easy. I was like, it took me 5 days to get monetized on YouTube, get sponsors reaching out to me. And then what happened? I got 5 inbound brand deals offers, and I lost all of them.
You lost all of them.
I just negotiated way too high. I was trying to, I think I was in that like know your self worth mentality, which you should know your self worth, but also know your self worth and do some research on how much you're charging.
Sometimes you have to be realistic about yes. the self will be worth, but today the self exactly. is worth.
I was charging like way too premium, and all of them were like, nope. And I was like, no. Like I just got to be firm on this. And they were like, yeah, no, thank you. And it was like good, like solid brands like that other creators had been using and had sponsored other creator journalists specifically. And yeah, I lost all of them. And then that was a big wake up call where I realized I needed to do a little bit more research on pricing.
So when did you actually then land or close, execute your first proper sponsorship? How many months into this? How many videos into this? And what was the brand? What did the partnership look like?
My first brand deal that closed was in June, and it was with this podcast from Amazon called This Is Small Business. And that one came about, you know, they say cultivate your relationships for a long time. I had worked with this company while at NBC, and they reached out. They said they'd been following what I was doing, and they asked if I could, you know, would consider doing a sponsored ad read for their podcast, which is about small business owners. So that would have been 5 months after launching, which puts me at like 10 videos after launching that I got my first sponsored brand deal.
Are you then too figuring out concepts well ahead of time and selling against those long before you've actually shot? But because you kind of have to do that to plan these deals in advance.
Yes and no. So one big thing that I've been really strict on with my journalism is that when I do sponsored videos, it really is just an integration and an ad read. So what that means is the sponsor is sponsoring that 60-second, 90-second ad read. They're sponsoring the video overall, but they have no control over what that video is about, who I interview, who I don't interview. So in that regard, it's like, you know, if I get sponsor X to sponsor my video that's coming out in February, I actually still don't know what that video is going to be. But there is that understanding of, you know, I'm a news journalistic brand, so you know, that video is going to be about something in that realm. For example, I just have a sponsored video that's coming out today, and it's about the obesity epidemic among Latinos and why Latinos have a much higher rate than other groups in the United States. And, you know, I think some people might consider that not super brand safe, but the brand understood that that's what they were getting into, and they approved it, and they were approved the video topic that was going to be associated with them. And I was expecting a bit of a battle, but they were totally fine with it.
I mean, I think more and more brands are getting more sophisticated about how to work with creators too. And you have to give up some of the things that you're usually not used to giving up when you're working directly with journalists. Let's talk though a little bit about your background as a journalist. So I want to get the quick overview. What I understand is that when you quit, you were working with NBC Telemundo. You were working in a bit of a national role with 40 stations producing segment shows. You'll tell me, but it was a really good job, kind of your dream job. You're producing video journalism, you're making six figures, and you decide to leave. Tell me what your job entailed at the time you left.
I love being interviewed by people who do research because you do good research. And I, now I understand how it feels to be on the other side of it. I'm like, what else does he know about me? But yeah, I was at NBC for 5 years working in this team that was called the Digital Innovation Team. And it kind of served as a national hub, as you said, that produced national content for all the 11 NBC stations, 30 plus Telemundo stations at this point. And the ethos of the team was, you know, we're going to cover national news. So for example, if Trump says something, we'll cut a video, which could be just a soundbite, or it could be something more produced, like an explainer video explaining Trump's speech that just happened, etc. So that we do that, and our local stations, NBC Chicago, Telemundo Miami, can focus on their local coverage, which I cannot do local coverage for Chicago or Miami being in Los Angeles, where I live, right? So it was a great job because on the breaking news front, it was a great ground to just train yourself on so many types of stories. And then eventually I got promoted to manager of digital video, special projects in OTT, which meant I was overseeing the production of a lot of our tentpole and special series. So NBC has the rights to the Olympics. That meant producing a multi-platform podcast that told the stories of rising Team USA stars that you maybe hadn't heard of before, but you're about to hear a lot about in the upcoming Olympics. I got to travel for that job. I got to cover 3 Olympics, which was amazing, with Paris being my most recent one. It was a great job. I always told my friends that it was one of the best kept secrets in journalism because it allowed you to work with really robust local reporters, but also with like such a national brand that is NBC. And I cannot tell you how many people respond to your emails when it's at NBCUNI.com. Coming from a previous shop where it wasn't as big of a name, like people would say yes, or at least respond to my email 90% of the time when I ask for it.
And has that dropped off now that you don't have
it? At the beginning, I was like closer to like 40%. But now I'm proud to say now we're closer to 80%. I still have a theory that a lot of my emails are going to spam because of my Gmail workspace setup that I have to figure out. That's what I tell myself to make myself feel better. But yeah, it was a great job. And after doing it for 5 years, something started to happen. A few things. They do say when you want to leave, you start looking for reasons in like even the cereal you're eating that morning, right? You're like, wow, there's a sign there. But one big thing happened, and that's that at the time that I was working at NBC, there was this division that had launched as soon as I joined NBC, which was called NBCLX. And it was a news outlet targeting millennial Gen Z American consumers. It was a fantastic job. I got to do a lot of really in-depth, like, premium style explainer videos for news, which is unheard of. You know, for anyone who works or has heard of working in local TV news, you work really fast, you do really short pieces, and you move on to the next one literally within 5 hours. With NBCLX, we were given more time. We had longer run times. You could do a 7-minute piece on X topic of your choosing that you thought would resonate with the viewers. So I did one story there that was about the future of Spanglish. And that video, you know, I interviewed so many people. I was kind of want to explore, like, is Spanglish going up or is it kind of dying? It's unclear to me. You know,
You've watched your Chicano English video, you'll know that these are two very different things. I'm gonna plug that video because it's really good. But anyways.
Thank you. A lot of people think, oh, Chicano English, Spanglish. They're two different things. Spanglish is the mixture of English, Spanish. You hear it a lot in songs. So I remember shooting that video. I probably like shot the interviews over the course of 2 weeks. And my boss had asked me like, oh, when do you think you'll, you know, have the edit done? I was like, oh, probably like next week, whatever. And I remember coming in, that was a Friday. And I remember coming in on a Monday with the final cut already done. And he's like, it was a 17-minute cut. He's like, wow, you edited that really fast. And I was like, you know what? I did. And I realized I edited it so fast, almost neurotically fast, because I was really passionate. Mm-hmm. What's up? I was in a flow state. Yeah. Totally. I was like, man, I'm like, I just want to know the answer to this question. I want to know how this story ends. And I was so geeked on it. I had all these motion graphics. And yeah, I had it by Monday, had minimal notes on the video. And then, you know, by Tuesday, it was published. And so that was the first inkling. I was like, I want to do more of this. And thankfully, I was at a place at NBC and Telemundo where it made sense to do stories like that. Not every day, but every now and then. And so, you know, then a few months later, I did a story on Hot Cheetos, Flamin' Hot Cheetos, why I had such a chokehold on Latinos. Another story that I edited super fast. And I was like, you know, I love doing these kinds of stories. And even with the most supportive like team and boss, I realized it wasn't like 100% brand fit for the NBC DNA. And it also wasn't 100% fit for the Telemundo DNA because these stories were in English. And they were really targeting like the kids of the people who watch Telemundo. Telemundo being a Spanish language.
Well, network. Which is, this is kind of the thing too, right? I would imagine the broad trends with broadcasters, NBC, Telemundo, probably both working hard to target younger audiences. And this, it sounds like what you're describing was a play to do that. But at the very same, at the same time, maybe they hadn't figured out a way to monetize it and still connect to those viewers because those viewers are on YouTube. I actually, well, I want to give a quick summary of something you wrote. In March, you kicked off your News from Creatorland column with TV News Check with a piece explaining why you left your job. And you give four distinct reasons. And you're talking right now about reason number two, which as you called it, was I wanted to fish where the fish were. The other reasons, reason number one is I wanted to learn about the business side of journalism, which you graciously referenced Creator Spotlight here, our interview with Lindsay Stanbury. But it's that. You wanted to fish where the fish were. Reason number three, craving a more direct relationship with an audience. And number four, you wanted to see what was possible. So sorry to interrupt, but that's what I'm hearing right here is you kind of got this taste of this is this content I could produce, but for this brand, for this company, they don't really have a way to get this content to the audience that wants it. But I can do that if I leave.
Yeah, I was like, I could do that with a click of a button tomorrow. If I really wanted to, I could do it tomorrow. Why couldn't I do it? Because, you know, you work at massive corporations like NBC, which have really, really tight restrictions on what you can do outside of work, which I understand. It's a huge liability to have all of your journalists just kind of, you know, doing independent work. I have more thoughts on that in a bit as well. But, you know, I was like, that was happening. And then the other thing, the big thing that was happening, I've been teaching a class at USC called Visual Journalism, which is a sophomore, junior level core class that journalism majors have to take. It's the basics of writing, shooting, editing, digital video. And at the end of the semester, I do a lecture on the future of visual journalism, where I kind of highlight three, four trends that I'm seeing in the space. And by the fourth year of me, you know, doing that lecture, I realized two trends had been on that slide for 4 years, and it was creator journalism and it was AI. And I was like, man, I have some gall to pretend to know what the future of visual journalism is, but I'm not doing anything in it. So I was like, let me put my money where my mouth is. I also had just turned 30, so that might have had something to do with it. And I was like, let's switch things up.
Yeah. Really quick on the class side, I think this is you teach three classes there now, I believe, or you're about to start teaching a third. But one of the other ones you teach is called Multiplatform Olympic and Paralympic Storytelling. And you just wrapped the semester as we speak. And you wrote this LinkedIn post that struck me. I'm going to read it. So one big takeaway from this semester: today's 19 to 21 year olds are innate video editors. We don't cover the how-to of editing in either of the classes I teach. I've been teaching these courses for about 4 years, and this is the first year I've seen high quality video editing across the board. No flash frames, interesting pacing, and sometimes even sophisticated editing tricks. The more I think of it, the more the quality makes sense. This is the first generation that had to edit video to be casual social media users. So I thought of this with what you were just describing, because you're saying like, these, you keep putting this trend on 4 years in a row, this is the future, and then it sort of becomes the present and you feel like you're becoming the past.
Yeah, I think with the class, I've learned a lot of things. One thing that happened 2 years ago, you know, I bring in guest speakers into the class, and I was really excited that I was bringing in a journalist from Rolling Stone to speak to the students. And I remember kind of teasing it. I told the students, guys, next week we have this journalist coming from Rolling Stone. And when I tell you, it sounded like I said, like, the Wichita Times, no shade to them. They were like it just didn't register. They were like, okay. And I was like, do you guys know what Rolling Stone is? And
they're like, yeah, Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah. They were like, yeah, you know, some of them like kind of identify it as an outlet, but they're like, yeah, okay, cool. And I was like, what? I was like, you know, when I was at USC, you know, as a student 10 years ago, I would have been so geeked. And then what
happens?
Which
is not long ago.
No. And then what happens a few weeks later, I tell people, hey guys, do you guys know who Cleo Abram is? They're like, yeah. I'm like, she's coming next week to speak to us. And it was like eyes lit up. And I was like, oh my gosh. You know, I knew that was happening, but to see it so concretely in front of me, I was like, man, I'd really have to be, you know, making a conscious decision to ignore what I'm seeing in front of me.
Hi there, my name's Tom. I'm the producer of the Creator Spotlight podcast. Just interrupting to give you a quick stat that I've come across, which is that 78% of the people that watch our videos on YouTube are not actually subscribed to the YouTube channel. Now, that means two things. One of them is that new people are finding our videos, they're watching them, but they haven't subscribed yet. There are also quite a lot of people that regularly watch this channel that also haven't yet pressed subscribe. Whichever one of those two you are, do us a favor, scroll down and click subscribe. We put out a new video every week speaking to a new interesting creator that we can all learn from. So subscribe to the channel so you don't miss anything.
Going back to those reasons, the four reasons that you wrote about why you left. So the number one, you said you wanted to learn about the business side of journalism. I was just speaking to somebody yesterday, not for a recording, but just chatting, and they work with a lot of journalists, and they were saying how that's every journalist they talk to has this difficulty understanding the business side. And in that piece that you wrote, you referenced the interview with Lindsay Stanbury, her point that there is traditionally a firewall between journalists and the business side of the publications that they work for. And at the very beginning of this conversation, you said that, not really a surprise, but that's been the hardest part to figure out, is this business aspect of it. So tell me a little bit about some wins here. How have you been figuring out the business side of independent creator journalism?
I have had some wins more recently. So one thing I did, I realized, okay, I've gotten a lot of inbound, not a lot. I've gotten a good solid amount of inbound volume for brand deals. But if I want to make this sustainable and I want to live off this, I also have to have some outbound deals. I have to start reaching out to brands that I think would want to work with me. And before doing that, though, I really honestly had no idea of how to go about that. Thankfully, people like Colin and Samir exist, and they have a course on, I think it's called like the Brand Deal Blueprint. And that helped me like make my initial sales deck. And I've already had some really neat successes with that, with the pricing alone and having a better understanding of packaging too and how to sell stuff. At the beginning, I was really thinking that you could only do one sponsor per one video and then got to start over, right? Let me find a new sponsor for the next video. But now it makes sense to me. You could sell a package of three videos, four videos, and that could be kind of your baseline. Like, I only do sponsorships that are three videos minimum. That's the commitment. It's a bigger ROI for you with my audience and also with production. It's just easier on my end. So that's been a big learning. And so now I'm in like a good cadence where I have more foresight too of like, okay, February right now is like looking a little slim. So like, what can I do? Maybe I can sell short form, which I hadn't really been monetizing up until like a month ago. I had monetized on TikTok, but yeah, in terms of sponsorships. Now I'm really excited because I had never really planned to monetize short form, if I'm being honest. I was just so laser focused on long form on YouTube and building an ecosystem around that. So now I'm starting to think of ways, okay, what can I do with like a three package deal for short form video?
Speaking of short form, you're on all the socials. On Instagram, you have 12K, TikTok, 14K, LinkedIn, 3K, Twitter, 1.7. This is all besides the 29,000 you are currently at on YouTube. I do want to hear more about how short form has become maybe an asset that you monetize, what that is for you, if you've been posting on it, the entire time. You said you're doing about three per week right now. What are these other platforms, these extra YouTube platforms? What do they do for you?
They, you know, I hate to use the phrase, but I'm going to use it. It's a great top of funnel to get people.
Wait. Okay, let's stop here for one second, because this is the thing. When we talk about, you know, indie creator journalists figuring out how to build their business, it's like, that's the thing is using words like top of funnel and not hating to say it. This conversation I was having with somebody yesterday, and look, it's this is the thing. When you come from a journalism background, or if you come from a more pure creative background and you're entering this world where you have to build a business, like, that's one of the things that people lack. I spoke to another person for an interview that should be out by the time this comes out. a guy who comes from a consulting background, right? Mm-hmm. And I was talking about this divide and why do all the people who, because there's been a few people who come from a consulting, like Deloitte type background, why do those people, when I speak to them, they have such these businesses are just dialed in and it's such a system and it's so in opposition to people who come from a more creative or journalism background. And this is a big part, is a knowledge of terms like top of funnel, which knowledge of a term like top of funnel just means a knowledge of how a media business works and how to bring revenue in and how to monetize subscribers. LTV, another big one, lifetime value, you know. Anyway, my little rant here aside.
HGTV.
HGTV. Okay. Now you're being smart. But this is the point, right? Like you have to, this is part of like actually building a business, is you learn a term like top of funnel and you just use it in conversation.
No, yeah. Well, it's so interesting you mentioned that, because I remember one of my first catch up chats with my former boss at NBC. Again, great guy, best boss I've ever had. I remember using the word inbound. I'm like, oh, I've actually gotten some good inbound. He stops me. He's like, oh my God, look at this guy, inbound. Check him out now. And I'm like, but you're right. There shouldn't be this kind of like, ooh, what are you talking about? Because as journalists, we're always thinking about the audience. Like that, mm-hmm. that's been like the last thing, the thing in the last like 10, 15 years. We're so audience centric, but when you're thinking about your audience, you have to think about the product you're giving your audience. As journalists, we are making a product every single day, whether that's the actual interface that your journalism lives on or even that specific video or article. Mm-hmm. So why aren't we thinking about these things? Why aren't we thinking about, you know, retention, about return customers, about churn, et cetera? And why are we leaving that to someone else who has a firewall and quite literally can't see what we as journalists are working on? Those additional platforms, I'm going to say confidently now, are a great top of funnel to expose people to my brand and what I do. So in every single video I do, which is three short form videos a week, I say, you know, my name is Fernando and I cover US Latinos, because I realize like my friends sometimes even forget what I'm up to, right? Mm-hmm. So strangers are not going to know what I'm up to. So I have to remind them. And so that's been great to like, you know, I just did a video, a short form video on Afro-Mexicans, which got me, you know, I think I could reasonably deduce like some nice traffic to the long form YouTube video, and also just awareness and followers there, so that I can create more of a full loop. What I don't do as much, which I'm proud of not doing, a lot of people will grab their long form and like split it up into like five different short form videos. I really do treat TikTok and Instagram as like standalone platforms, where I pretend that if I were just like a short form video creator, what would I be creating for the platform? And I think that's helped me. I think that's given me nice returns, where I'm not trying to force this like 15-minute mini doc into three separate short form videos, because, hey, I spent all this time and work and money working on this long video. I need to juice it as much as possible.
So I didn't watch the Afro-Mexican one, but I watched the long form. I watched the YouTube. Mm. And I'm guessing, based on one or two other of your short forms I watched, that you're basically taking the same research and just turning it into a 90-second script.
Yep, exactly. I do rewrite everything for short form. I'll change the hook. I don't change the visuals. Like I use the same B-roll, but I'll change kind of the, at least like the first 10 seconds for sure. And obviously, you know, it's a vertical video and I don't just like grab a 16:9 horizontal video and slap it on a 9:16 template. So that was totally built on the research that I did for that long form video. But you know, thinking more of like, what would people on TikTok be curious to know about? Cause there is a lot of really good nuggets in that video. But I decided to take a more like US centric approach to the TikTok video.
Okay. That makes sense. So how are you actually making your living right now? You are teaching three classes, about to be three. You have some brand deals coming in. I imagine that you have not yet regained the full salary you were making before you quit a year ago, but what are all the different ways you're making your living right now?
Yeah. So I do teach two classes at USC, but I teach three classes because one of those classes is a repeat. So I do two sections of it. And then now with this creator journalism course, like it's a sizable like chunk of, well, I don't want to give anyone bad ideas. You don't make a lot of money as an adjunct, but you make enough money to get by. And then, I've gotten some speaking gigs, which I was not forecasting at all. So that's been a nice little surprise. And then what I do is I do this like conglomeration of freelance gigs. I try not to do too much editing because I try to reserve my creative energy for my channel and for in the hyphen. But I find that's the easiest type of work to get. So I've done, you know, editing for like
great at it as well.
Thank you. It's my strongest skill, which is like, well, might as well use it. So I've done, you know, like freelance editing for like motivational speakers on Instagram, you know, like cutting videos of their speeches, finding the best hook. And with that, with my USC part-time teaching gig, I'm definitely making less money than I was at NBC. But now that we're recording this, like, you know, I've 3x my revenue within the hyphen. So I'm hoping to keep that going.
That's amazing. Let's talk about the video production itself for a little while. So first, you're publishing about 2 a month. You're 11 months in at the time of recording and you've published 24. Most videos are around 13 minutes long, really ranges from about 11 to 23, but they're mostly around 13. Is this a sustainable pace?
Yes, I can confidently say that now. When I first started, the big mistake I was making was that if I had a video publishing in 2 weeks, I would spend those 2 weeks, every single day of those 2 weeks, stressing about this video. You know, if I wasn't researching for the video, I was doing interviews for the video. If I wasn't interviewing for the video, I was out shooting B-roll for the video. And about like video 4 or 5, I was like, man, I am working every single day on these videos or thinking about these videos every single day. And as much as I'm passionate about the topics that I'm covering and the questions I'm answering, I knew it wasn't going to be sustainable long term. So I told myself, I was like, well, you know, I could stress out about this video for 2 weeks, or I could time box it, another corporate media term. I could limit myself and say, Fernando, you have 4 days to work on this video, figure it out. And I knew I could make a good video in 4 days.
This is the thing. Like for me, I'm somebody who, you know, we've got a twice a week newsletter schedule and it goes out at the same time every Tuesday and every Friday. And Natalia, assistant editor here at Career Spotlight, she writes most of those these days. But when it was just me too, it's like, it's very easy to just fill the whole week. And then, you know, the last 2 hours before it sends, you're in it and it's this thrill and I'm addicted to this like deadline based work. But the trick, and I think this is something that's really hard when you're independent, like yourself, when you don't have somebody telling you this has to be done at this point, right? Like it's very easy to just, it has to be done when I have to publish it. So how have you achieved, you know, rearranging the deadline chemistry in your head?
Well, the upside is that now I have downtime and now I can go to the thrift store on a Sunday and just live shop, but not buy anything because I don't have to buy it. It's not an errand. It's like, I just want to go to the thrift store and just look. I just want to go to drink coffee, not to answer emails, just to drink coffee. So I told myself too, because when I left NBC, I realized, you know, I was working a lot and at minimum 40 hours. It was a good team to be a part of, but I also realized if I'm going to take the leap and leave the security, I also want to build this like, not, I want to say idyllic life, but a better work-life balance. Mm-hmm. So I told myself, I need to figure out a way where I am working 30 hours on a video that publishes every 2 weeks. So 30 hours within 2 weeks. So that's 15 mm-hmm. hours each week. So that when this grows, I can start filling in those other hours with different revenue streams or different projects that I want to take on that aren't necessarily tied to in the hyphen or my bottom line for in the hyphen. So I kind of set that limit of like 30 hours. So I told myself, how do I do that in 4 days? So it does mean that like my interviews take around like 4 hours to complete. Most of them are virtual, but sometimes I shoot in person. Those probably take closer to an hour per interview, whereas virtual interviews take closer to 30 minutes. And then writing, you know, I'll do that in like 4 hours for a script where I'm still kind of doing some research there, as I write. And then editing, which is probably what I'm the fastest at. Like I can get a solid like video that's at least 10 minutes long, probably max like 17, 18 minutes in like 16 hours. And I did that this week. I did it last week. So that's sustainable. And I kind of enjoy having that like deadline of, as you say, like this is going to end Thursday at 9 a.m. because it has to. Like I just have no more time because I got to get the video up. And so that's also a good challenge to not chase perfection. and focus more on like the story selection, at least right now. And then later, you know, once I have more time, I can start thinking about, you know, the actual more experience that I'm creating for my viewers. Right now I have a good format going, so I'm going to keep doing that format, but innovate more on the topics that I'm selecting and thinking, what can I do that I haven't done yet that I've been a little too scared to try?
Well, tell me more about that, because, you know, it sounds like you've got a decade of editing experience at least. So that's just the skill that you've really developed. The story selection, the ideation, what's on my beat and also will hit on YouTube. I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah. So my overall beat is US Latino culture. And within that, I kind of think about it as three buckets or content pillars, where I have business, history, and culture, which I know is a little redundant.
What's an example for each one? What's an example, sure, like a video that fell in that column and really hit?
Okay, business. I did a video on Bimbo, which is the largest bread company in the world. It's a Mexican-owned company. It owns brands like Sara Lee, Thomas, the English Muffins. So that was a video that did really well. It kind of walks you through the story of Bimbo and their strategy and how they've grown. And then under history, we'd have something like AAPI Latinos. Why you see so many AAPI Latinos in the US? That's a very like history dense video talking about immigration patterns, policy in the US, anti-Asian sentiment in the US, how that's changed. And then we have culture, which is the one bucket that I had to add in because it's videos like Chicano English, where Chicano English is a video about history, but it really is in the present tense talking about how culture is changing, how Americans are speaking and how that is changing. I had that bucket as language before, but I was like, that's weird. Like, I don't want to be the language.
That's too niche, maybe.
Too niche. I don't want to be the language journalist. Yeah. Like, I enjoy stories about language, but I don't want that to be my niche. So those are the way I think about those three videos, those three verticals. And now what I'm doing as of this month is I'm going to start investing more in my videos. And what I mean by that is one big advantage I've had this whole time is that I don't have to hire editors. I don't have to hire videographers. I'd have to hire reporters because I'm doing everything. What I want to do now is investing in my videos. And that could be, you know, I hired someone to shoot B-roll in Mexico for my Afro-Mexican video. I'm going to Mexico in a few days to shoot a story. And that allows me to really think about the story that I'm doing and whether it's worth that investment. And I think it also pushes me to make a better script, to make a better edit, because I'm realizing I've invested so many resources into this video. Let me make it an experience.
It's a forcing function. There's more at stake.
Exactly. Whereas before, you know, it was a good like runway to just kind of like experiment, see what topics. I didn't have my content pillars before, even like 3 months ago. So that allowed me to have that. Now I can drill down in those content pillars and think about, okay, how am I telling these stories and what makes the Fernando way of telling these stories unique?
Yeah. So let's talk about the Chicano English one quickly. So we were talking about how many views it had. I wrote this down last night. It was at 646,000 as we record. So doing amazing. And like I said, that is 3.7 times as many views as your next most popular video, which was published, I believe, just a month or two ago. But this one, Chicano English, was published on January 30th, 2024, 3 days after your first video, which is where you explain, here's what In the Hyphen is, here's what I'm doing, I left my job, the backstory. Obviously, there's a factor of this has been around the longest of any of them, and so it just accrues views. But looking at on your short form as well, I think on your TikTok, the short form version of it is your most popular video there, or if not the most popular, it's the second. I maybe it's as simple as this is something that so many people have seen. Well, where does that little accent come from, right? Like, why is that a thing? And so it's really widely relatable in a way where the market for people who want to know the history of Bimbo, right, probably a bit smaller. So I don't know. Am I overthinking it? Is it just that there's a big market for that? Why do you think it hit so well?
I think because it's probably the biggest curiosity gap I've had on a video. And what I mean by that, it's the biggest curiosity gap I've had on a video as a journalist.
Yeah.
Like I knew I'd heard this accent, but I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know it had a name, and I didn't know why I was hearing it everywhere. And so in the video, you'll see like I take you along the journey as I'm learning stuff. And without a doubt, it's the most research I've done for a video. I think it's the most number of interviews I've done for a video. And so I see a very direct correlation there. And then, of course, you do have that like semi-familiarity with the word Chicano. People know what Chicano is, but they've never seen it juxtaposed with English. And you're like, wait, what? Like Chicanos speak a different English? I'm Chicano. Do I speak a different English? And since January 30th, I've been chasing that high of that video and I haven't quite gotten there yet, but I'm glad that I now have different reference videos that, you know, haven't been quite as popular, but have been relatively
popular. A bunch of them are above 100.
Yeah, which is like so great. Like, and but a lot of my identity language videos are like my most popular. Mm. And so that's something that is exciting because I'm like, oh, those stories are really fascinating to do. And they're also a little easier to do because when you're doing people-centric stories, you're not waiting on the FDA to respond to a request for comment. Yeah. You're not, you know, waiting for some executive to give you an interview. You really are just interviewing people about their experience.
I mean, this literally right before we hopped on, I was halfway through your AAPI Latinos video. And there's the part I was at, you go to West Covina, which I don't know my Southern California geography too well, but I know you live in like the LA area and this is also vaguely in the LA area. Mm-hmm. And you go there because there, you learn that there's a lot of like Latino Filipinos there, right? And so you pull up to a mall just to get a coffee. And then it turns out there's this like Japanese cherry blossom festival. And you're like, well, I bet there's some folks here. And you just run into all these people and you're having these amazing interviews with all these interesting people, right? And like that kind of thing, like I love seeing that in a simple way of when I think about like the difference between what's a journalist and a creator, like this is almost like just very basic journalistic thing of going out there and collecting primary source information so that if you're just information that if you're just making a video essay, you might not do. I kind of forget why I started talking about this. I love this video, but I think the point is like, going out there, doing this research and just talking to a lot of people. And there's a clear skill that you have too, where people are, where you're warm and people are warm back to you. Like the smiles on these people's faces and they're like, it, you probably didn't have a lot of time to talk to them, but they've clearly opened up really quickly. Now I think I'm just flattering you, but people should watch that video anyways.
No, keep going. No, yeah. Oh, okay. But I think go ahead. Yeah. You make a good point about process journalism too, where I always love seeing how journalists do their work because I hear it from my friends. I hear how hard it was to get that interview or I hear how easy it was to get that interview because you walked into a mall and you found these people. But in news and in journalism, so much of the industry has been about the finished product. Just show the finished product, the 2-minute 30 piece, polish it up nicely out of the graphics package that we have for the station. And we forget that people don't know, a lot of people, I should say, don't know how journalism works.
Most people,
I have friends who ask me like, oh, how much did you pay for that interview? And I'm like, no, we don't pay for interviews. Or at least most journalists that I know don't pay for interviews. So showing that, but also you're so right. I think in journalism school, I heard a lot about get in the field, do on the ground reporting, door knock. And increasingly, you know, even as I was in my corporate career, I didn't really door knock. It was a lot of online outreach. Whereas now within the hyphen, it's fun to just go put myself in that mall or for Chicano English, I put myself in this market in Mid City, which is a very Latino neighborhood here in Los Angeles. And I found people because if when you fish where the fish are, which is a good business lesson, but also journalistic lesson, you're going to uncover really cool things.
Yeah. On any of the videos that maybe haven't hit like that view count high of, you know, over 500,000, are there any metrics? Is there any video that has like some metric that you're so proud of where like this one had a crazy click through rate or the average watch time? Like everybody is still watching halfway through. Is there any one video you can think of where one of these, invisible, more, you know, behind the scenes metrics just really hit?
Two videos come to mind. Bimbo, our lovely bread, what did I call him? Bread Daddy in the short form version. I mean, it's the highest click through rate I've gotten on a single video. I think it was like north of 10%. And I'm proud of that. I think it was a thumbnail. I added like red laser eyes to the fluffy, cute Bimbo bear. And that those are ideas that come to you at the gym and you're like, I can't wait to get home to execute this idea. And then on a way more unquantifiable metric is the AAPI Latino video. I think it's the highest number of comments I've gotten after Chicano English. And the comments, it wasn't just the quantity of comments that I received. It was what those comments said. I joke that sometimes my my comment field on my YouTube videos feel like a discussion forum on Blackboard, which if you remember your college days is what people use to, you know, submit assignments. Because people come with the really researched comments of like, I read this book in college. My sister told me about this book. I heard about this public figure that people should know about in the AAPI Latino space. Those comments are cool, but the really cool comments were things like, wow, I'm so glad someone finally made a video about this. I always thought I was the only one. It's so cool to see myself reflected, which, you know, as cliche as it can sound, I think is what journalism is. It is, mm-hmm. is its job is to reflect what's going on and not give a voice to the voiceless. I hate when people say that because these people do have a voice. And actually now with social media, the voice is pretty loud and you'd have to choose not to listen to it to say that they're voiceless. The voice is there. You just kind of got to go capture it.
Yeah. So I wanted to get the numbers for you here. We have 104,000 views here and 770 comments, which is really amazing. And it's, I mean, I'm just reading through them now. And if you're watching this, just go watch this video. If you're listening to this, go watch the video. Look at the comments. It's really sweet. I, at the very beginning, I asked you, some of, you know, it's your first year, what's been disappointing, what's been hard. We never got to the wins. We've gotten to some of them, just in the course of the conversation, but I want to explicitly ask you, what are the wins of this first year? What are you most proud of?
So many things. I was preparing for the interview before this and I was like, oh, let me write down my wins and losses. And it took me like 35 seconds to write down my wins. And it's a pretty big list. And then my losses, not to be, you know, I want to paint an accurate picture. I was having a hard time coming up with losses because there is so much that so many good things that come with the liberty and freedom of being an independent creator journalist. And so starting with the fact that I get to decide what to cover and that I get to do stories about my community is really cool. I told myself when I launched this, would I be okay if this didn't make a single penny ever? And the answer, truthfully, I don't think I would have done it for 10 years, but I think I would be fine doing it for a year, 2 years for free if it meant that I was adding some kind of value to the conversation around the US Latino experience in 2025. If in 10 years, people could look at my videos and say, oh, that's so cool. I got to see what it meant to be a Latino in the United States in 2025. I was like, yeah, that's worth it. That's cool. But then more quantifiably, I'm really proud of the fact that, you know, I monetized on YouTube after 5 days. My initial projection was a year. So that came 360 days earlier than planned. The speaking gigs was cool. You talked about short form and how I think about short form. All of those speaking gigs came through my short form content. Then I think then people watch my YouTube videos, but a lot of them thought I was like a TikToker is what they called me when they reached out, which is fine. I have no hangups about that. But I was like, no, I have like longer videos too, if you want to see them. And then the creator journalism course getting approved, me pitching it, me developing the syllabus. That's a huge win because I think it shows, and this isn't a me thing. There's people who've been doing this longer than me that are being so loud that journalism institutions are paying attention to this space and taking it very seriously. So that's been lately my biggest win. And then finally, the qualitative reception. I'm stoked mm-hmm. about the numbers. Like I am doing much better than I thought I would be, you know, a year in. But the qualitative reception, I mentioned this quickly before launching. I did this entrepreneurship lab with the Google News Initiative that kind of mm-hmm. gives you the know-how of like, how do you make a revenue projection? How do you make a business plan? And one thing they make you do is write 3 comments that you hope to get on your work. That'll make you feel like you're having impact. And I remember writing them verbatim, like, wow, I'm so glad something like this exists. Wow, I've never seen a journalist cover us in this way. And I kid you not, I've gotten those comments almost to a T with some.
I mean, I bet there's hundreds of those on the AAPI Latino one we were just talking about.
Yeah, this is your 5th time mentioning that video, so now people better watch it.
Tom, link it. Tom, producer Tom, link it right here. I'm pointing to where you're linking it in the YouTube.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, no, that's awesome. I mean, I was waiting to come back to that too. You were talking about you know, you could do this. Maybe you would do it for 10 years without getting paid, but you would do it for a while because it was contributing something meaningful. And I was like, that's quite quantifiable in the comments themselves, in the volume of comments you've got. I think on the Chicano English one too, it's like 2,700 comments or something. It's quite a few. What are your goals for year two?
So I want to double down on the creative. I am in a good place where I know how to publish consistently, which is one of the biggest tips I got when I launched, was be consistent. Okay, I know how to do that. And now what I want to do is think more intentionally about how I'm making these videos. You know, I had a really brief idea that I was like, oh, should I do music video journalism? I don't think I'll do that. Someone else can take that idea. But in that vein of like, what can I do that makes sense for me as a person? Music videos do, but not the singing part. I'm like, I am not a singer, so I don't need to be singing. But I was like, it'd be fun to do like music video journalism. So I want to think more creatively and take bigger swings in terms of the presentation of these videos. Like, how is this story being told? Where am I going for this story? So you're going to start seeing a lot more travel in the, in my videos, domestically within the US, but also in Mexico and other parts of Latin America. Not every video based on budget, but I think pretty regularly. So I'm excited about that. And then two, I will be launching a newsletter, in part because there's so much reporting that I sit on that I don't make anything from it because I'm like, oh, I don't have good visuals or I don't have like enough information, but I do have enough information. Let alone the time. Well, now, yeah, that's why I've left those hours like free, to be able to kind of craft this nice little product that documents the US Latino culture every 2 weeks. So that's what I'm working on next. TBD on a launch date, but I'm pretty excited about it. And I think it'll be a nice feedback loop between my YouTube channel as my top of funnel to get really nice subscriber quality coming into the newsletter.
Yeah. So new video products and a newsletter product, big themes. Yes. What must not happen? What would be failure in year two, right? Like what just cannot happen? What are you afraid of? That's what I'm asking you, I guess.
Well, it's funny. I do have this, I have a podcast I do for my Patreon subscribers that kind of pulls back the hood on the business side of in the hyphen. In October, I did a spooky season themed episode of this podcast that was called What I'm Afraid Of. So I'm glad you asked that question. A lot of things. I mentioned my wins list being so long and so easy to write. My fears list is pretty long too and easy to write. I'm afraid that I'll plateau, that I miscalculated the TAM, the SAM, and the serviceable addressable market for this. I'm afraid that I am biting off a little too much, that maybe I'm telling too much of the Latino experience, and maybe I should just focus on the Mexican American experience because I'm Mexican American and I shouldn't try to speak about Venezuelan American issues. I have gotten zero indication that I shouldn't be doing that, but that's just something I think about in this, you know, very diverse US Latino landscape. And then I think, you know, there's always this fear with the platforms. I'm it's not lost on me that I'm so reliant on, yes, I'm an independent journalist, but I am so reliant on third party platforms, including Patreon, including, you know, when I launched a newsletter, email service providers, I'm dependent on whatever they do or whatever they don't do. So there's always that like in the back of the head, in the back of my head, but also I think I'm preparing against it pretty well or as well as I can by diversifying my revenue sources.
Last thing, word to the wise for any journalists considering following you, leaving their place of work, starting their own thing. What's the one thing that you would say? Know this.
I have one. Grab a credit card, 0% APR. And I'm saying this because this is what I did. Grab a credit card, 0% APR, buy $9,000 worth of equipment. And I bet you'll launch your creator journalism business tomorrow. Why? Because once you have that looming 9,000 loan debt, you're like, wow, I better get going on this. And so that's what I did. I kept pushing back the date of when I would launch in the hyphen. And I was like, I know what gets me going. Debt. Like, I don't like having debt. So let me, this is terrible financial advice.
No, this but this is great advice.
I was like, if I don't have this looming over my head, I won't have a goal too. So I told myself I better make this money back in a year. Otherwise I'm going to have to start paying interest. And I'm proud to say I made it and significantly way above that. And so that was like kind of like under me to that kept me going and told me like, okay, you said you're leaving in January, you better leave in January.
That's, I love that, because whenever I ask some kind of advice question, it's, I often get a, you know, a tepid milquetoast answer. This, you know, maybe we put the legal disclaimer here, you know, this is not financial advice. Like, I always love when they do that. But I think that is such a real piece of advice. Literally bet on yourself. You just literally place the bet. And, if you don't bring it in, you're going to have to pay.
When you ask what's the worst thing that can happen, it's probably being in crippling debt still from that. But thankfully we're past that now.
We're past that. And this has been a great conversation. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Listener, we will see you next week.
Hi there. I'm Tom, the producer. If you liked that episode with Fernando, I recommend this episode with June Lee. He also left corporate media to become an independent journalist, but focusing more on sports. It's a similar path, but a completely different story with different lessons. It's a good episode. Go watch that one there.